content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Joe Austin, and I'm your host and producer for today's episode of Legal Matters, an original program produced in the North Carolina Reading Service studio. For the next half hour, we'll be exploring topics, and we want you to be able to champion and empower you to afford you legal rights to obtain equal access and full participation in our community and to achieve goals of independent living. Every fourth Tuesday of each month, you can find us here providing news and information from federal and state agencies, as well as nonprofit organizations that promote information on laws supporting independent living. And in today's episode, our guest is Kevin Siglowski from Pointer Spruill. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jeff. Glad to be here.
We're so glad to have Kevin. Kevin is an acknowledged expert on labor and employment law in North Carolina and with a very prominent law firm here in Raleigh, Pointer and Spruill. Kevin, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background? Our topic today is going to be something neither one of us studied in law school. It just kind of got set upon us due to circumstances. But tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Thank you, Jeff. And I will be brief because I'm sure that talking about myself is not what folks are tuning in for today. My name again is Kevin Siglowski. I'm a partner at Pointer Spruill. I practice almost exclusively in employment law. I've been doing that for long enough that I have to think back to how long that's been, about 17 years now. And I do about half litigation and half not litigation, but all of that, again, is in employment law, which would include harassment and discrimination claims, claims involving the Family and Medical Leave Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act, both of which I would expect we'll talk about today, and a lot of work and interaction with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is federal agency that has published not the only but probably the most guidance about COVID issues, vaccine issues, types of things that I believe we'll discuss today. That's a little bit about me, and happy to follow up on any of that, Joe, if you want me to, but that probably gives folks enough context to understand what we're going to be doing today.
Yes, and I will say that, as I said, Kevin is an acknowledged expert. He recently did North Carolina Bar Association program in their expert series on developments in employment and benefits law from COVID-19, and he's fresh from that program. And we, as I said, this is a topic that neither Kevin nor I took up in law school because there was no such thing as COVID-19. And it's only been within the past century or this century that there's been any talk of how to deal with pandemics as a subject in labor and employment law. But I think the EEOC issued some guidance several years ago about what to do in pandemics, and it seems like we forgot everything when COVID-19 came upon us and 2019, but take it up from there, Kevin. That we had this event that was very dramatic change from business as usual and an impact on labor economics and labor law. Can you tell us a little bit about what the federal government did in response to that? And, of course, I'm talking about the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. And I guess it came upon us like a low-pressure system, and now it's pretty much broken up. But kind of walk us through all of that and tell us what remnants are left, if any, of that.
Sure. Happy to do that. And perhaps it'd be useful overlay to all of this for folks who may not have experience witnessing how quickly or not quickly the federal government passes employment laws and rolls out guidance about how to implement the laws it passes. I would say from my view, the speed of government, at least insofar as it relates to employment law, not dealing with the medical side of COVID. The seat of government is probably a bad match for a pandemic, and by that I mean the timelines between when laws are proposed and announced and when they get passed and when they become enforceable on employers and employees tends not to move nearly as quickly as case rates, vaccination rates, death rates. And so I think that's a lot of what we've seen in terms of COVID and employment law is things getting announced and getting passed at paces that maybe don't match up with the situation that we're dealing with day to day. With that said, so the Families First Coronavirus Response Act was, in short form, a federal law that required employers to provide paid leave and paid time off for dealing with either contracting or being quarantined because of COVID or for other reasons for providing child care because regular child care was unavailable. I think given our time frame today, it is probably not good to spend a ton of time on this because what I would say is this set of laws was required from April 1st, 2020 to December 31st, 2020. Hasn't been mandatory for going on a year now. Employers could opt into providing this through September 30th, 2021, which is, of course, now a day that's also behind us. And by opt-in, I mean employers could agree voluntarily to provide these leaves and take the tax credit for what it costs them to do so. And as we sit here today on recording this on October 18th, and whoever listens to this, it'll be after that date, this law is really no longer applicable. So I think probably a broad brush description of it maybe is warranted. The only thing that would potentially matter to folks going forward is if you're an employer and you provided this type of leave anytime in 2021 before September 30th and didn't take the tax credit, you can go back and scoop that tax credit up now on your next quarterly filing. But the details of this, I would say, Joe, are no longer relevant because it's had a sunset period now.
Right. We've dispelled the notion that there are any remnants really for the employee or prospective employees of any protection, so to speak, under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. But the one thing that remains with us even after that is COVID-19. Certainly, it becomes relevant under several federal laws. You want to just kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of what will apply to COVID-19 issues in labor and employment law.
Sure. So there's, from an employee's perspective, two broad concepts that you talk about. One is the Family and Medical Leave Act, the FMLA, which will apply to some employers and then some employees, but not all. And then the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, which will apply to, again, not all, but many more employees and employers. So brief overlay, and I'll call it the FMLA, Family and Medical Leave Act. That covers employers that have at least 50 employees.
Yes.
And there are also time and service requirements. So if you're an employee who works for a huge company, you, from the company having enough employees, you have to have worked there for at least 12 months and at least 1,250 hours in the 12 months leading up to your need for leave. So there's two categories of eligibility standards there, one for the employer and one for the employee. So if you work for a small company, that law is not going to apply. If you work for a big enough company, but you haven't worked there long enough, it's not going to apply to you. The Americans with Disabilities Act is going to apply to employers with 15 or more employees, and there's no time and service requirement there. And in fact, the ADA will apply to applicants, folks who are in the interview process. So that is a much broader set of protections. In terms of where the FMLA might apply, where the FMLA is going to apply is if you get COVID or you have a family member who gets COVID and there are medical consequences of that, it is possible that you will qualify for FMLA leave. Whether or not you qualify will depend, again, on whether your employer is covered and then whether you as an employee or an eligible employee. And then beyond that, you have to have other things. either you or the family member has to have a serious health condition, have a specific definition under the law. I think for purposes of today, if you were hospitalized with COVID and you're otherwise eligible, that will qualify you for FMLA leave. Or if you have a family member who is hospitalized, the other possibility is if you're out of work, incapacitated for 3 or more days and have a, what they call a regimen of continuing care, which could be as simple as consulting with a physician and telehealth counts, potentially you'd be covered. You know, what does the FMLA provide? It provides up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave, job protected leave, meaning you get up to 12 weeks away from work and or whatever subset of that is required to get better. And then your employer is required by law to restore you to the job you had before you went on leave. So that would be the FMLA aspect of COVID.
Let me follow up with some questions about that, Kevin. So under the FMLA, I take it then that serious health condition is a serious health condition is a serious health condition, like a rose is a rose is a rose. There's no differentiation now between COVID-19 and any other serious health condition that might qualify you or qualify you for the leave under FMLA. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's correct, Joe. And what I might say is there's no difference, and that means COVID has neither more nor less protection. So if you have a serious health condition that is COVID or symptoms of COVID, then that would qualify, but you also don't get greater protection. So if your personal experience with COVID is such that it's not hitting the definition of serious health condition, you don't automatically fall into the FMLA because it's COVID.
In your experience, and of course, you work with a lot of employers, primarily, I think, but in your experience working with employers and without giving away any trade secrets or confidential information, how are employers dealing with the COVID-19 regime? We can say that it's the same as any other disability, but in practice, is it working out that way? Is there some apprehension, increased apprehension over COVID-19 in the workplace?
I would certainly agree with that latter framing. I think there's increased apprehension. There's confusion, political and cultural aspects of COVID. Get people concerned and emotional in different ways than probably any other type of disabilities we might encounter against folks in those states of mind. So I think for all of those reasons, it is certainly not viewed in the same way by employers and causes a lot more stress. And as you've mentioned, this is new to all of us, right? So there's limited guidance, and us as attorneys and employers and everyone else trying to deal with this thing is trying to apply a framework that was developed without the benefit of knowing how to deal with COVID to the COVID situation. Sometimes that framework fits, sometimes it doesn't.
Right, right. So then you mentioned the Americans with Disabilities Act, and that's something that we talk about on Legal Matters quite a bit. But can you give us just a overview of the ADA from maybe a 30,000-foot view, and before we go into how COVID fits into that?
Sure. So the ADA, as your listeners are probably very familiar with this law based on what you told me about the topics you cover on this program, but ADA, in a very broad sense, has two broad requirements. Obviously more to it than that, but the two broad requirements are an employer cannot, and make sure I'm framing this correctly, there are different sections of the ADA. I'm talking about the section that deals with employer-employee relations in the workplace, not public accommodations, which is a whole other topic for another time. But from the employer standpoint, there are two broad requirements. One is you cannot, as an employer, discriminate against employees or applicants who have disabilities. And the second broad requirement is you have to provide some parameters, reasonable accommodations to folks who have disabilities to accommodate their disabilities. when we talk about the ADA in the context of COVID, there is an aspect of it that would involve whether COVID or symptoms of COVID or long COVID are disabilities that has not sort of shaken its way through the EEOC and the court process yet. We can try to draw some analogies on whether COVID is a disability or in what circumstances it might be, but where it's coming up much more frequently today, this week, this month, it is in the context of vaccine requirements. And whether accommodations need to be made to those requirements. So when we talk about the ADA, that is the majority of the questions I'm getting, the news articles you will see if you Google ADA and COVID is adopt the vaccine requirements.
Go back, Kevin, if you will, and just kind of do a little back and filling about the disability issue, because you know, I think in the public's mind, anyway, you get COVID-19. Well, that must be a disability. I mean, it would seem, at least to the lay mentality, that would go without saying after all that we've been through. But disability under the ADA takes a little bit more than that, doesn't it?
It does. So to be a disability under the ADA, a condition has to, what they call, substantially limit one or more major life activities. There was an expansion in 2008 of the ADA, the ADA Amendments Act, which expanded the universe of conditions that would qualify for disability. Probably, without getting too technical, the easiest way to think about what might not be a disability for purposes of what might apply to COVID is a transient condition, something that somebody is afflicted with, but it resolves fairly or very quickly with no follow-on effects. So perhaps the easiest example would be if I get diagnosed with COVID-19, have a positive PCR test or sequence a positive PCR test, and I'm completely asymptomatic, and then I test negative, and I have no ongoing shortness of breath or elevated heart rate or cognitive impairment, no visible or obvious or testable symptoms, and I feel fine. In my case, COVID-19, the mere fact I got diagnosed with COVID-19 is probably not a disability. There are certainly circumstances where I would advise somebody that it should be treated as a disability, and that would be a situation where it does not appear to be resolving, or I'm sure you know plenty of folks who've had COVID as I do. Some folks are not better after months and months, and it may never be fully recovered. Permanent, or at least what appears to be permanent, lung capacity issues or cognitive problems or elevated heart rate. Those folks, I think I would advise anyone to treat them as disabled under the ADA, which may not mean anything. You know, they may be able to perform their job. So if I'm advising an employer, I may say, well, you can't fire them for having had COVID because you're discriminating against them for having a disability. But what are we really talking about here? I mean, they're doing their job, and perhaps it's not implicated.
So that's kind of like it's also a disability if you're regarded as having a disability. So I guess what you're saying there, you give them the benefit of the doubt up to a point. A lot of times a quick fix that is an accommodation is better than being absolutely correct about your legal interpretation of what's going on. But like a common cold, that's not going to be a disability, even though you feel terrible for a week. And the flu's not going to be a disability, even though you feel terrible for a week or more. And COVID-19, if it sets upon you and you recover from that, that may not be a disability, but it's those sort of the aftershocks of the disease that may get you into a troublesome area and bring on the ADA coverage, I guess.
That's correct. And as we've done these COVID training sessions, presentations, and seminars, inevitably in doing employment law and dealing with Americans with Disabilities Act, sort of have to talk about medical things. Obviously, I am not a doctor. I don't play one on TV or radio, but you sort of have to apply some common sense to the medical situation here and say, all right, well, I don't understand for sure what long COVID is, but if I'm got my lawyer hat on and somebody had COVID and is reporting that they're continuing to suffer symptoms and they're calling it long COVID, my advice to an employer would be the prudent approach is to treat this person as disabled, not spend a whole lot of time arguing or debating or trying to figure out if they have a disability, and focus on whether or not you can make an accommodation.
Right, right.
That would be the more fruitful and prudent use of an employer's time.
Amen.
And I would suggest that the EEOC thinks that's the right approach, too.
Mm-hmm.
The EEOC certainly in recent years has suggested employers would be well served to focus on whether or not they can make an accommodation rather than whether or not somebody has a disability.
And speaking of accommodations, pre-COVID, I would say that our courts took critical view of telework as a reasonable accommodation, and even though that seems to be the wave of the future in people's minds, that maybe the courts were not as receptive to that. But then we and you may agree with that or disagree with it, but then we have the shutdown or the quarantines, and everybody's going to telework. Have you noticed any sort of a judicial change of heart about telework as a result of sort of these sociological issues?
So, yes, in terms of judicial, I don't know that this has worked its way through the courts yet. Your assessment and your description of the critical view of telework is certainly quite accurate. What I have seen is the EEOC has, so obviously there are lots of us at telework, not everybody. There's some recognition that was a way to keep people productive to some extent, if not fully. The EEOC, in an effort to, I think, encourage employers to allow telework and versus forcing folks back into the workplace, certainly before vaccines were widely available, has published some guidance suggesting or saying directly that the mere fact that an employer allowed telework during the pandemic does not require the employer to continue to allow telework in the future, or it's not definitive that telework is a reasonable accommodation just because an employer allowed it reportedly for a limited time with COVID. On the other hand, my view on this is if you have allowed telework during the pandemic and employees have been able to perform their jobs successfully and your company has been able to operate successfully, that history will not totally be ignored if in the future employees request telework as reasonable accommodation for COVID or for any other disability. I think those employees will be able to point to the very real experience and say, well, you can't tell me that I'm completely unable to perform my job on a telework basis because for 18 months or 2 years or 3 years during COVID, I did that 40 hours a week and things went great. So this remains to be seen. That's me speculating to some extent, but I would anticipate that would be an argument and perhaps one that would be quite logical and persuasive. That, you know, although the EEOC says it's not going to be held against employers that they allow this, I would expect employees to say, well, that's all well and good, but clearly I can do my job remotely because I did so, and you can't just pretend I didn't.
As the old boy said, proof was in the pudding.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, although the EEOC can say, well, this isn't going to be automatically held against employers and, you know, used to show that telework is reasonable, I certainly think it would be evidence of it. How could it not be?
Yeah. Well, touch on the vaccination issues as COVID-19 and is that in the realm of ADA issues?
Sure.
Touch on that.
This is obviously the hot button topic of the moment. before September 9th, much of what I would talk about is, can an employer mandate the vaccine? The answer to that question was yes, and then I would talk about what that meant. On September 9th, President Biden held a press conference where he announced that OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which is part of the U.S. Department of Labor, was going to publish a rule, they call it an emergency temporary standard, that would require all employers in the country with 100 or more employees to have a vaccine or test mandate. And at the beginning of our discussion today, I made some reference to the speed of government. That's been, whatever that's been, 6 weeks at this point as we're sitting here talking. There is no such rule yet. They are allegedly working on it. The way this happens is they don't tell you we will publish it on a particular day. They publish it whenever they publish it. So at the moment, there is no such rule, and there's much speculation about what that will mean. But even in the absence of an enforceable rule, my experience has been employers who had not mandated the vaccine have been more likely to mandate it in that intervening 6 weeks because they're expecting this federal rule to come. They're trying to get out ahead of it. So I think certainly the mere fact of conducting the press conference has caused more employers to mandate the vaccine. But in terms of, on a very basic level, where this is, if your employer mandates the vaccine, that is legal. If your employer hasn't mandated the vaccine and there are 100 or more employees, it is likely that they are going to have to mandate it here soon. And if you either currently or in the future work for an employer that has a vaccine mandate, what does that mean for you? It means you are going to either have to get vaccinated or request and see if you can get granted an accommodation either based on disability, which we touched on, or based on religion. Different employers and, frankly, different courts are handling the religious accommodation requests in very different ways, but that's sort of the standard. And whether or not, it's twofold analysis. One, whether your request for an accommodation is reasonable, and then in some cases and for some employees, even if reasonable as a request, the employer can't in that particular job make an accommodation, and those folks are getting put on unpaid leave or in some cases being terminated. So it's very highly charged area at the moment.
Amen.
That's where that fits.
Amen. Well, Kevin, we're going to have you come back on. We'll have another half hour program on religious discrimination. How's that? But anyway, this is.
Yeah, happy to do it. That's a tough topic to cover.
It sure is.
Time, other than to say, what I'll say briefly is some employers have taken the position that they will not entertain any religious accommodation requests.
Right. Well, Kevin, we want to thank you for coming on the program. This is a very informative and timely program. Thanks very much for being our guest. I'm going to wrap things up now, but please, we'd love to have you back. We've run out of time for today's episode of Legal Matters. Please be sure to tune in next time, fourth Tuesday of every month at 2 p.m., and then we rebroadcast on Wednesday at 7 a.m., We hope you've enjoyed the show and discovered information about your legal rights in order to participate in our community. I'm Joe Austin, your host and producer for the North Carolina Reading Service.